continue on a Monday. And joining me is Montana Man, as you know him. We know him as Rob Schwarz. Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Marine Corps, retired. What's going on?
Not much. Where at the house in Idaho.
At the house in Idaho. Oh, I thought you went the other way. So give us the what's the weather situation in Idaho? Is it cold? Is it warming up? It is the end of January, which means it's winter up there. But I'm trying to lean into spring a little bit.
Yeah, we're waiting for winter still.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so. No, it's been mild. It hadn't been shit for winter yet. I mean, it was kind of that half-ass wanting to be snow today, and still going right now.
But, well, I mean, you need to go up a little bit further north then and hang out with Bev a little bit. She's got some winter headed her way. Yeah. She's been doing some winter up there in Saskatchewan.
Yeah, well, we haven't got it here. I mean, as far as Idaho winters, it hadn't been bad. And shit on the Montana side at the ranch there, it's like spring. I mean, 40s. It's been 40s for like 10 days.
That's impressive.
That's really impressive. I mean, I'm just waiting for, you know,
is there going
to be February to crush us?
Yeah, I know. It's got to come at some point.
It's coming.
Global warming is what's the impact if it doesn't come?
Well, on the ranch here in Idaho, we worry about water in late summer for irrigation. You know, streams getting dry and irrigation getting crappy. But on the ranch in Montana, it's fishing is what I'm worried about, because there's just not going to be a lot of water for the fish.
But this is, it's not like you've had 4 years of this or anything like that, right? Things have been pretty normal.
No.
Right?
Oh, no, it's been great. Okay. All right. We've had two huge years.
Yeah, two huge winter years?
Yeah. I mean, as far as snow, hold on, I'm about to have to get after these dogs.
Oh, yeah, what's going on?
Hey!
I just had to settle that.
What's going on? I thought you had well-disciplined animals up there.
They did, but they were on their own for a second.
Really? Well, there you go. The you and a platoon that you commanded in Somalia had a bit of a sad anniversary over the weekend, and you would we had texted about it, and so I wanted to have you on for a few minutes because I think it's so cool what your guys have done, and you got a chance to participate a little bit this year. First of all. Can you take us back to Somalia when you're a platoon commander and tell us what you're doing there and what happens?
Yeah, no, it was a little different. Or yesterday was the actual day that we lost Lance Corporal Botello. But up until that point, we've been there probably 6 weeks in Mogadishu, and we were working for Task Force Mogadishu, then commanded by Colonel Klimp. So we're away from the battalion. Charlie 17 was, and his mindset was
hold on. So what year is this?
92-3.
Okay, and so has RCT-7 been there a while? Is this the first iteration of it? Give us a little background on the deployment to Somalia when you're there.
Well, the Mew landed in, I think it was November, December, and we were right behind them.
Okay.
And then Charlie Company peeled off and stayed in Mogadishu and worked for Task Force Mogadishu and Colonel Klimp, and then the rest of the battalion went further north. So Colonel Klimp's kind of philosophy was, we'll patrol the city and react. And we did that for, I guess, a month, month and a half.
Okay, so then, so for people that don't recall that deployment, right, President Bush, the elder, right, he sends Marines into Mogadishu, and the Rangers at some point show up. And it's a humanitarian issue. They're having a civil war there. But there's video coming back out of Somalia that the American public reacts to. And as a result, Marines get sent there, the MEW first, and then everybody else shows up after that. Is that a fair synopsis of it?
Yeah.
And again, not much of a military mission there, but you know, people starving to death, and you know, the American people were outraged by it, and President Bush reacted to it. And so Rob and Charlie 17, commanded by Bob Brueggemann, was he still there?
That was him.
Bob Brueggemann, a friend of mine who we taught together at the basic school and the infantry officer course. Booger, as he was known to his friends. And he was a massive human being.
Gronk is what we were calling him.
He was
with a giant freaking jaw.
Oh, man. He was massive. Right? And so
he's a pastor now. Did you know that?
I did know that. Yeah, he's a pastor.
Yeah.
So anyway, so what was your mission there? You know, who and when you patrolled, who were you looking for? Bad guys? You know, any specific bad guys or bad guys in generals? Or
it was we did a fair amount of weapons confiscation type stuff, patrols.
Right.
You know, because you know, we laid down the law when we got there, and only certain people could have weapons, and you had to have a weapons card, and these are your rules of engagement. It was extremely complicated at the lower levels to, you know, for the young Marine. And I mean, pretty soon after that, that's when Krulak started talking about the strategic corporal, and it was that. I mean, it was that. That corporal had to have, you know, the ability to decipher between, is that a bad guy or just a guy with a gun that I need to go take it from because he's protecting his house. It was a tough time as far as the rules of engagement go, and young Marines trying to figure out what are we doing. And I took that platoon, and they had just got back from Desert Storm. And they had gotten stop lost. So here's Second Lieutenant Schwarz, fresh out of the basic school. And, you know, half the platoon is fairly disgruntled, just to have to be there, you know, to go on that deployment. So it was a, it was kind of interesting on the leadership side of the house to keep those guys, you know, focused on what we should be doing. And just to understand it.
All right. So talk to us about the night. So what are you doing in general? You're doing presence patrols in the area, making sure that the bad guys, however you decipher that, aren't running the streets.
Well, like I had said before, previously, we had just been doing more presence-type patrols under Task Force Mogadishu and then reacting to any incident we got into.
Okay.
But when the battalion came back...
And hold on. And who would you... The incident that you would get into, who would that be with? Is there an opposing force? Is it simply a series of warlords that are protecting their own turf?
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Got it.
And you just don't know which one it is. Right. You know, and it could be somebody just protecting their house, or it could be a warlord, and you could have a standoff. You just didn't know. But it was that night, that week, was a complete change when the battalion came back to the the stadium and took over that AO, because we had not done local security patrols at all. We had done none. And this was basically the first local security patrol that was done around that soccer stadium in a month. And it was at, you know, we inserted in AAVs, piled off, got into the brush at probably 2 o'clock in the morning and waited, you know, just like you're taught in IOC, and let your eyes adjust. We sat there for 45 minutes to an hour, everybody just not moving. And I had offset my second squad by 45 minutes. And they were going to run a patrol parallel to us just to mutually support. And as we were, you know, laying there in the brush waiting, you know, those tracks went by on the road. And we were supposed to clear a compound that, I mean, literally was 300 yards from the soccer stadium where the battalion headquarters was. And we bounded across the road. Squad leader, point man, being Batello, one of them, they peek into this compound, and I can see it. And that's right when we got PVS-7s.
Explain what
from
those,
the other side.
Explain what those are to everybody.
Oh, monocular, or well, double eye, night vision goggles, which hell I hadn't seen before I got there. So I could see across the road how big this frigging compound was, and there was 16 of us, if you include the machine gun squad and me. And the only reason I was there was because it was mandated that a staff NCO or officer had to accompany every patrol. So there I am on a patrol that it's not my patrol. You know, it's literally the squad leader's patrol that he's running. You know, I'm there basically because I'm told to be there. I mean, I trust the squad leader. He's running a patrol. I mean, it's his job. We train for this specific met that he can do this. And then, you know, by mandate that, you know, you have to have an officer just basically sitting in your back pocket so you can go do your job. I didn't like it, but I mean, it was, is what we had to do.
Did the colonel,
and he,
did the colonel ask for your opinion before he like put that guidance out?
No.
Oh, okay. Just checking. he didn't call down to Charlie 17 and said, could somebody send Second Lieutenant Schwartz up here? I need an opinion on how we're going to run this shit. He did not.
Yeah. No, officer, staff, NCO on every patrol.
Wow.
And so there you are. It's just, you know, I mean, what's your job other than to, you know, reel it in if it gets bad? And
so what was your job? How, what did you do?
Well, when? The whole patrol? I mean,
well,
he wrote,
yeah,
the,
I mean, how did, how did you,
he wrote the overlay.
Right. How did you define,
I mean,
your job?
He briefed the patrol.
Okay.
And I said, I will be, you know, he is behind first fire team.
Right.
You know, he's fourth man back.
Right.
And I was eight man back.
Right.
You know, so he's running his squad like he should be.
Right.
And so he bounds across the other side. And I think now that you talked me through it, I realize what my job was. He calls back to me, and shit, this was back before inter-squad radios. We were working on Motorola's Uncovered. You know, those little ones you get at Radio Shack?
Right. You guys bought those? You guys bought those?
No, we bought those ourselves, yeah, before we went over.
Wow.
And he calls back and says, hey, sir, this thing's freaking huge. He goes, we can't take this with 16 of us. And I said, roger that. I'll call back to the battalion and say, hey, we're going to divert and come. We're not going to clear this freaking thing in the middle of the freaking night. We're going to continue on the regular patrol route, which basically took us just to the west of it. And the wall of that compound was no shit, 3 stories high. And the road we had to go down was right next to it. And we eased down that. And Batella was the point. And Corporal Lamb, his team leader, was cover. on NVGs, and there was an opening probably the size of a, oh, it was probably 50 yards by 50 yards. And Botello got halfway through that thing, and I was eight man, so I was back there a bit. And I heard Lamb yell, Botello, look right. And green tracers start coming from a rooftop. And I saw one go down and not come up. And then I saw a second one go, you know, coming at an angle from a rooftop down. And then it ricocheted off something and went horizontal. And both of those hit Botello in the chest. One went just under the shoulder of his flak, and the other one hit a 203 round on his chest. So he goes down, and then a little firefight broke out after that. And we had no intel. That was the thing. We just didn't know shit. And we were going blind the whole time, was what made it worse. So we don't know who these people are. I mean, it could be a guy protecting his house we just stumbled on. I mean, hell, we'd been a couple hundred yards away for a month plus and never came to his house. And then we show up in the middle of the night, so you don't know. What we do know is that somebody was shooting at us, so we were shooting back. And we did drop the guy on the roof. I saw him go down because we were punching 203 alum in the air. And I saw him go down and the guy at the gate go down. And there was a third dude that we had guns up at that time, machine guns up. And I don't know if we got him or not. And then call back to the battalion requesting a medevac because we know we got Botello down. And they wouldn't send one because they didn't know if the area was secure.
And how are you medevacing?
Humvee.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, shit, man, it was freaking couple hundred yards away.
That was it?
No, I mean, you probably had to travel 500 yards on road, but it was, by the way, the crow flies a couple hundred yards. Oh. So they wouldn't come get us. So I got on the horn with, then of course, my other squad was hearing the whole thing go down. And I don't know if I told them to come or those guys just showed up. But they were still on tracks at the time. And they drove up behind us. We backed out. So, and these kids were...
So hold on, just so that's right. This is how different, right, life is today.
Oh man,
you were it's on. So different. Were you on goggles that night?
I wasn't. No, we didn't have enough of them. The cover man had goggles. That was it.
So your number two guy in the number two guy in the squad movement has a goggle.
Right. Okay. So he's covering point.
Right.
And
is he the one that yelled?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So now when do you get to Botello, and you know, is he do you have him stable? Is he urgent?
No.
He's urgent from the start and they won't come and
yeah.
won't get him.
No, it was I heard it. I mean, I'd hunted enough in my life to know what that sound sounds like, that death groan. You knew it was in his lungs. And I was freaking eight man back, but of course, you know, I was moving forward as soon as it started. So, but I heard it and I heard that groan. And, so here's where the whole freaking thing is complicated is that squad leader is still running the squad.
Right.
I mean, I'm letting him run that fire and movement, because that's what we're doing at that point, is, you know, he's bringing guns up, and two kids who, and this is why I love the Marine Corps today, you know, they're probably the, you know, they got, between them, they got three NJPs, I think, the two of them, and we're hunkered behind this wall, And they go, hey, sir, we're going to get him. I go, no, stay here. And they looked at me and they looked at each other and off they went. And they went and drug that fucker out of there.
So, it, I mean, so then what? Now, how do you solve? So, I mean, honestly, I mean, the way you were set up actually good so that you could try to run the medevac and the squad leader can fight the squad, which is a pretty decent, division.
Oh, it's a decent setup.
Yeah, decent division of labor. What happens next? And you know, I wish, you know, in Iraq, we used to use the term urgent surgical, which differentiated from urgent, you know, was that urgent was that the injuries were life-threatening, but they're not going to die, you know, within an hour, you know, and that was urgent surgical. And so there was a, but I don't believe that's a NATO classification. So when we went to Afghanistan, we didn't use it. And I didn't like that. I thought when you heard somebody was urgent surgical, you know that they were, their life was on the clock. And, so how does that get resolved for Botello?
What do you mean? How did it get resolved?
Well,
I know.
Does he, so Botello dies right there and there is no medevac?
Oh no. Corporal Dobbins, my other squad leader, came back with the tracks.
Got it.
And we piled him in the track. And I mean, I can still to this day remember standing in that TC hatch. You know how that sublight kind of right. is inside right. those tracks?
Right.
You know, they've got them flashing down below the radios. I can still see him and the Marines working on him as we're backing out of there. And I can remember yelling through the radio at the second track, cover our freaking six, we're going, just trying to get him back.
Right.
You know, as long as somebody, I just wanted somebody to look behind us, you know. And shit, it was less than a 5-minute ride to get him to a regimental level surgeon.
Got it. The let's talk about a lot of people deal with this. How do you deal with it? Every year, you know, the anniversaries crop up. Everybody knows from post-traumatic winning that it never goes away. How do you deal with it?
Well, I mean, I dealt with it myself for the most part. You know, I just made time, you know, 25 January every year. And my best friend was and he was my roommate in 29 Palms. He was in Bravo Company. And, you know, I might email or text him. You know, and say, hey, remember the day? I mean, he wasn't there. I mean, he was in country. He knows what it means to me.
Would you sit the fuck down for a minute?
I did. Right. I did. I had to take a leak.
I wonder why you went outside.
Yeah. So, no, I'd talk to him. You know, send him something. And, you know, I sent him something yesterday. He actually sent me a picture of his gravesite. I mean, out of the blue, like 5 years ago, he's in Texas and Botello's buried in Oklahoma and he was up there on business doing something. I mean, out of the blue, I get a picture of, you know, his gravesite. So, I mean, just reaching out to somebody who knows, you know, shit, this is what it means, you know, and kind of understands what you're freaking thinking on that day. And this year was a little different. I just connected with the kids in the – I call them kids. Shit, they're only 3 years younger than me.
Exactly. How old are those kids now? You said it was 27 years ago. So they're like – those kids are now like 47 years old?
Yeah. No, there's – I mean, fuck, Botello was 3 years behind me. I mean, I looked at that gravestone yesterday, and I was like, shit, he was not – you know, he was born in 71. And I was born in 68. You know, so, you know, connected on Facebook. And I don't even know what even who the catalyst was or who the first one was. But like I said, those guys were kind of a bunch of hooligans when I first walked into that platoon. You know, they're post Desert Storm. They fought a war. They're getting ready for EAS. And all of a sudden they get stop loss and we get sent to Somalia. So they were fairly surly bunch. And trying to, especially in that touchy situation over there, trying to keep everything going the right direction was difficult.
So have they hung together low all these years?
Oh man. And I didn't even know it. I didn't know it till this year that how tight they were. I mean, the corpsman, squad leader, team leader, and about four or five others of them have become great friends with Patello's family. And they'll go up there kind of on a retreat, you know, once a year. I think somebody in the family owns some backcountry property in Oklahoma that they go out to and just spend a few days in the woods together and then go visit his grave. And I didn't know any of this shit until last year.
Most time guys who stay on active duty aren't as connected as guys who get out. It seems to be the so did you correspond with those guys? Did you talk to any of them?
This year I did. Well, I mean, and like you said, once you get off active duty and you start to reflect a little bit, you know, I paid attention and saw what they were doing, and I sat down yesterday morning and I was thinking, and I haven't changed my Facebook picture things in, well, ever since I got on it. And I posted his gravestone and then a picture of the platoon actually in Somalia on there. And then all of a sudden all those guys piped up. You know, they just showed up on Facebook. And then through the day, you know, just started chatting, you know, back and forth on Facebook. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to, you know, start a group text with these guys and talk about it. And it was just amazing to connect with those guys and feel it.
Right.
You know, be able to feel the like pain that those kids went through on that day, that it was the same for me. So it was, it's blue collar counseling, man, is what it is.
No, I mean, it's what we talk about, right? It's that, you know, we all go through it, and don't be afraid to talk about it, because, you know, what you're going to talk about is probably on somebody else's mind. And how much better it feels, you know, all of a sudden you start talking about it and you start sharing your own feelings and you find out that they're going through the same thing, and it feels a lot. I mean, you know, just like when you were together, it's so much easier to go through it together than it is, you know, when we're all faking it and trying to act like it doesn't bother us or shit like that. So you lived a little post-traumatic winning over the weekend.
Yeah. The fucking crazy part is it's, you know, 27 years later.
Oh, like you're going to get over that? I forgot.
Well, no, I mean, no, not you're going to get over it. But I mean, it was like, holy shit. I mean, we could talk about the minute, you know, and the situation.
Yeah, no, you know, that's what's crazy about, you know, the brain, right? I mean, if you watch that documentary, Bravo, okay, you see those guys describe something, and they're describing it in slow motion, high definition. It's amazing. And it was, you know, Quezon over 50 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's the same deal.
Right? I mean, and it's like, if you want testimony that you don't get over it, watch this guy and look at his facial expressions. He's seeing it, right? He's seeing it, right? And so
no, and when you asked me to describe it tonight, I was there.
Right.
You know, I can see it, and the fucked up part about it is my mind goes back to when we drug the machine gun team up. They laid those guns down just like a gun drill on bipods, though. And they laid them down, and there's a big old clump of rocks in front of them, and he freaking lets that first burst go. And I'm like, holy fuck, dude, you just shot rocks right 2 yards in front of your gun. Because you can see the muzzle blast in the dark, right, and you can see the impact on those rocks. And I'm like, somebody grab him by his freaking shoulders and get him to freaking get that bipod up.
Whoops.
I mean, that picture was in my head when I was describing it. I mean, right, so clear.
No, I mean, and that's why, you know, again, it makes me feel good that, you know, that we're advocating for living a different way, you know, because we're, you know, everybody out there alone with those feelings on this day or whatever day people have them. And just don't be alone, man. Just don't be alone, because if you think you're the only one that's got them, right, you are, you know, you're full of shit. You're full of shit. And
no, and then the feeling that you get when you, I mean, you get that text or email or whatever it is that comes in a situation like that, and even reach out, you know, if it's just a text, you know, and then the response. I mean, fuck, on Facebook, it was all over the damn place.
Right.
I mean, the responses, and you, and as a professional Marine officer, you've got to put that shit behind you as a second lieutenant, you know, because that's part of your job.
Right.
You know, that's what you're there to do. And then 27 years later, all of a sudden it's like, oh, fuck, I didn't even know that was buried somewhere.
No, that's why we do. I mean, I wish, right, Vietnam guys would have talked about their shit more with us so that we would have had a better understanding of it, a more mature understanding of it. So, yeah, you know what? You're not going to put this behind you, okay? There's going to be times whether your life slows down, whether something happens, and these things are going to come back to you. And the truth is, you're never going to get away from them, and that's okay. I mean, I wish somebody, you know, I mean, I was really lucky, you know, that I had a gunny that had been given good advice, and he gave it to me. A lot of guys don't get that advice. But it's really cool, though, Rob, to hear, you know, and talking to you earlier today, you know, how good it feels to be in their company, that, you know, misery sucks, pain sucks, but it sucks less, right, when we're all together suffering.
Yeah, and, no, that's the...
It sucks less when we share it. And,
that's an
age-old fact. And when it sucks less when we're there for each other. It sucks less when, you know, when we help each other. And, you know, and that's the key to, you know, just to get through it.
Yeah. And, no, I realize it more and more. And as you stumble on this, because you did stumble on it, as you're figuring this shit out, it's all freaking rock solid truth.
Right.
and you go back and practice it, and you think about it, and you talk to people about it. And as soon as you tell them, you know, this shit's not going to go away. It's just part of what you're living, man. And that baggage that you're dragging around with you, that's a freaking gift, you know, that you can give to somebody. And that's when it feels like a gift, is when you give it back and go, all right, here's where I come from. I've got some cred. Here's my shit. And oh, by the way, your shit's serious. It's not going away, but it's part of us. It's what we deal with. And it's part of freaking life. And oh, by the way, once you digest that, go ahead and take it the next step. And then pass it on to somebody else, just like I did you.
No, that's it right there. That's it. If you do that, you're gonna take your life to someplace that, you know, it's probably never been, and you're gonna find a place that you probably don't know doesn't exist, and also in that way you're honoring that experience. You know, you've taken the wisdom from that experience and used that experience to help somebody else, and which ultimately helps you. And so, I mean, to me, it's
the best part for me is you're making that. In this case, we'll talk about Lance Corporal Botello's life, and you're adding value to it by helping somebody else with that experience. You know, he's not going away. You know, he's going to hang around and help other people.
Right. No, and you're
that's
no,
where
no.
you win.
That is exactly when you give your suffering meaning. And you essentially turn that liability into an asset. You turn that hole into a trampoline. And I try to figure out ways to explain in visual terms. You know, that thing that happened, I mean, I wish I could go back and erase it, but I can't. And the only thing I can do is I can take that hole and I can turn it into a trampoline. And I can vault myself and other people up to there, and honor him, honor the experience, and honor the people I was there with by doing that. And that's the way you get through it. And so, no, I mean, I thought that your story over the weekend was cool, and so I wanted to have you on and just a little bit of post traumatic winning over the weekend. And you know, and I'll tell this story real quick. I got a call this morning at about 11 o'clock. Maybe earlier than that. And it was from somebody from Camp Lejeune, who's been on this radio program, a sergeant. And he said, "Hey, could I talk to you?" And I said, "Yeah, you could talk to me." And he said, I'm trying to help a fellow Marine. His wife's really struggling. And, you know, and he kind of told me the story. And I said, "No, you're doing everything right. Okay. You're doing everything right. Just be patient, right? Patient, persistent, present." And he said, "Thank you." And I said, "No, you don't have to thank me, man. Just change your life." And he said, "I'm going to." And so, I mean, that's how this whole thing gets played forward. That's how it gets better. And that's what's so beautiful about it, is that, you know, this these difficult things that happen in life, you know, you know, 27 years ago, Lance Corporal Botello, you know, killed in the line of duty in Somalia, you know, and you look back and like, what the fuck were we even doing there, right? And you get frustrated sometimes for that kind of stuff. But all that shit out of your control. The only thing you can control is your response to those events and how you use those events to change other people's lives and ultimately transform your own. And your Marines are doing that, man. And you did a little bit of it over the weekend. So congratulations. Nice going.
Yeah, no, they're amazed at those knuckleheads, just seeing them knowing them then and then seeing what they become now and how they've gathered around this and actually his family.
Yeah.
You know, they've been there for him. I mean, that's something.
No, it's a tribute to our culture. It's a tribute to the way we love each other. And how deep the experience is that you know, low 27 years later, you know,
yeah.
the Marines of, you know, what platoon?
Second
platoon, Charlie 17, Suicide Charlie, I think, right?
It is Suicide Charlie, call sign Street Gang, because the day we were getting ready to leave, the morning we were getting ready to leave for Somalia, my corpsman, a squad leader and a team leader showed up, all shaved heads. One of them, I think he had about 10 or 15 stitches in it. And I said, "What the fuck happened to you guys?" "Well, we were at the drive-thru at the Del Taco last night in 29 Palms. We got in a fight." And I was like, "Fuck, we got to get on the bus in like 15 minutes. Are the cops coming?" They're like, "No, sir, I think we got it covered." And off we went to fucking Somalia, hoping that we didn't get any freaking kind of legal notices showing up in the mail while we were there. Yeah, that's where my call sign came from, Street Gang.
Nice. All right. Yeah. I don't want to take up any more of your time. I appreciate you taking time out to do this, Rob.
All right, man.
All right. There you go.
Thanks, Mac.
Yeah, Montana Man, also known as Rob Schwarz. More of Auburn Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.